The Library of Congress has 147 million items, 33 million of which are books situated on 838 miles of bookshelves. If these bookshelves were laid out in a line and a very motivated and fit reader wanted a book at the other end of the shelves, it would take him approximately 4 days of running at top speed to reach his destination. It takes less than a second to perform a search of this magnitude in a digital collection, and you wouldn't need to shower afterwards either. As print goes digital, experts are hoping for a trustworthy, flexible, accessible, and intelligently designed source for digital media of all sorts. Starting in December 2010, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University took on the challenge of coordinating the building of a Digital Public Library of America, commonly referred to as the DPLA. On October 21st, the DPLA will convene a meeting of over 300 participants in Washington, D.C. to officially kick off construction on the project and navigate some of the challenges it brings. This meeting marks the beginning of a 2-year period which will culminate in the release of a live national digital library prototype to readers, listeners, and viewers the world over. Since its inception, the library has engaged a wide variety of voices in the planning process. Peggy Rudd, director and librarian of the Texas State Library and Archives Commission, spoke to us about some of the challenges facing physical libraries.
We were cut and our budget was just slashed in our last legislative session. So at the state level, there's not a whole lot to be excited about now. You know, I laid people off over the summer, and I've consolidated two of my divisions into one, and, you know, we're just in a very sort of hunkering down kind of posture. And then I look at DPLA, where it's like all sunshine and lollipops, relatively speaking, and it's like, this is so exciting, and there's so little that's exciting in my professional life right now, you know, and I think there are a lot of people that feel that way, that, you know, it's tough times.
Jill Cousins, executive director of the Europeana Foundation, spoke about the potential for digital libraries to complement traditional libraries.
I think they are a means of being able to get the user into the libraries, actually. There is a lot about relevance of libraries, museums, archives to what is now the internet-driven way of finding things out. We had a very interesting conference this week in Vienna called Europeana Tech, and there was a guy from the BBC, Bill Thompson, who was saying that actually this is the generation, this one now, where we know how you learn things in the past, the kinds of depths and of information and stuff and richness of material that we have in our libraries, archives, museums. And we know that the internet is a way of exposing it. Whereas you can see the following generations who have not been brought up with learning through books, through going to the museums, beginning to ignore them completely because they're only going to find it online. And if it's not online, it's not there. Which is why he felt that we have a duty to really get as much of it digitized as possible, as much of it available online. And I think that's a huge public mission that the DPLA is undertaking. They're ensuring that people realize that our traditional institutions are extremely relevant to our future.
Though some worry that digital libraries will usurp traditional libraries, Peggy Rudd also sees extensive benefits for physical libraries in the creation and popularization of projects like the DPLA.
I think what it does is it frees libraries to recreate themselves in perhaps a much more meaningful way because they don't have that brand of the book hanging around their neck. There's always going to be a need for public libraries. They are always going to be community assets. I think at some point, people are going to be awash in content, and they're going to be able to get it without going through a middle person, and in this case, the public library. So what that means is that the public library is going to have to reevaluate what kind of asset is it going to be in X community? Is it going to be there to provide public access technology for individuals who need that? Is it going to provide workforce development? Is it going to be an avenue to e-government? Is it going to be an avenue to health information? Is it going to be an avenue for the creation, for helping people create digital content?
Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive, discussed different models of digital libraries in the United States today.
Well, there are two digital library projects going on in the United States. There's kind of these two approaches, sort of more of a centralized approach with centralized funding and a distributed approach that has a lot of libraries involved. And the DPLA, it'd be interesting to see which way the DPLA goes. The cost of building the a big library, say of 10 million volumes, of which the open world is now 20% of the way through. If you take the Bahati Google library, it's already past the 10 million. So in some sense, they've already built it, but it's a subscription closed system that doesn't allow bulk access. The open approach is 20% of the way through, and the cost to go and complete the library to be a 10 million volume library is about $160 million, which is a big number, but still is, you know, a few days of how much it costs a library system in the United States to run.
Of course, digital libraries aren't unique to America, and Amanda French, that camp coordinator at the Center for History and New Media, sees some benefits to South Korea's centralized digital library system.
The National Digital Library of Korea, aka the library, is a building, as well as a series of services for the Korean public, and of course a website the Korean public can go. What's interesting about that to me is that it's a very, very centralized model. The Korean Digital Library is not only just a fabulous building with all kinds of things like 3D monitors and, you know, lots and lots of computer labs and laptop spaces for people to work, multimedia editing facilities. They have those essentially like surface tables where you can read digital books on a digital surface, essentially. So it's not only all of that, but it's a really centralized place for managing sort of digital library services for Korea. And I'm not sure how well that model would work in a country as large and diverse as the United States and as sort of historically decentralized as the United States. But it is true that when you look at the kinds of things they can do in Korea by centralizing things in that way, you do get a little bit of envy. For instance, they can standardize, even just the library card system for public libraries in Korea. The sort of Digital Library of Korea was sort of charged with setting up a system where you could use your library card, you know, anywhere.
By contrast, the popularity of digital libraries in Europe has given rise to a largely distributive system, and Jill Cousins discusses some of the challenges raised by this diffusion.
There is a proliferation of similar projects across the world, and they are bigger and smaller depending on where they're coming from. So that, for instance, in Europe at the moment, we're facing a lot more national portals popping up, which would be very sensible. So there are ones which have been established for quite a long time, such as Collection.fr or Cultura Italia. But then there are new ones, such as the Deutsche Digitalbibliothek and the Finnish one, whose name I can't even begin to pronounce, but it's a Finnish National Digital Library. And there's a lot of those happening. And then you've got the issue of how do you get users to the information that's held in all of these different places, possibly held in duplicates. And ultimately, that's who we're all servicing.
But Brewster Kahle is wary of a one-size-fits-all approach to the DPLA.
Well, the DPLA is still in formation. I think the answer of having one library for everybody is not a good approach. When the great waves of libraries in the United States, whether started by Ben Franklin with subscription-based libraries, it was a distributed system. And when Carnegie helped fuel the public library system, again, it was a very distributed system so that there was lots of publishers, lots of authors, lots of libraries, and everybody's a reader. And where the internet does allow for centralization, it also allows for decentralized systems. So we're really excited about the decentralized, democratizing approach of the internet.
Jill Cousins also stressed the importance of a collaborative process.
Some of the things that the DPLA is already doing is very clever. So, for instance, the beta sprint, where in a way it was looking to see what people had already done and getting them to submit so that they could be properly assessed. And that was really quite clever, because it's a means of getting people to stand up and be counted, but also to be able to see what's out there that you can make use of. So you're not reinventing the wheel. And for me, I suppose one of the lessons which would be great to be able to pass on is that we don't reinvent the wheel, that we take some of the work that's been done on this side of the ocean and see how the DPLA can improve on it and make it better. Maybe even say, no, this doesn't work at all, so act as a kind of peer review. I do think we have to find ways of working constructively and in a complementary way with each other. And for me, I suppose that means that we need to make sure that everything we do is truly interoperable, so at the sites level, but also at the data level, so that the data can be easily swapped, the licenses are interoperable, all of those kinds of things.
Peggy Rudd and Amanda French shared some of their hopes and visions for what the DPLA could become.
I think there are so many pieces that are already in place that are going to move the DPLA forward much more quickly than I think the enormity of the vision would suggest possible. So I think once DPLA deploys, I think they're going to begin to have a tremendous influence on the marketplace. They're going to be able to incentivize and drive use of and reliance on and broad distribution of standards. You know, we in the library world are trying to do this in our own spheres of influence. But the DPLA, I think it can move that outside the realm of library and information science, you know, outside our profession, and really move it into the world of publishing much more effectively than we in the library and information world have been able to do.
I actually also have more of a dream vision than a sort of goal vision, which is that, and even though it sounds a little radical, I would love for the Digital Public Library of America to be a physical place as well, a building, or one or more buildings, you know, somewhere, you know, could be in D.C., could be anywhere, could be a number of buildings where people could go and really not only access the content that would presumably be available through the online presence, but also get a lot of great services related to working with digital content.
And finally, Peggy Rudd looked ahead to the plenary meeting later this week.
I think it's going to be great to have at the plenary session this what I hope is going to be a very large group of individuals who have an interest, but who come from every discipline, every walk of life. I hope it is as diverse a group, but all people coming together interested in the DPLA, and to sort of take this little seed that we've been nurturing, and we're going to share it with the world and say, okay, you know, here's where we are, here's the vision, here's how we think everybody can play a role in making this happen. What do you guys think? And it's kind of dangerous, but it's exciting too.
You don't have to wait till 2013 to see how the DPLA will shape up. You can follow along and get involved by visiting on the web at dp.la. For the Digital Public Library of America, I'm Benjamin Matafaffrey.